some attempt to phase into the pocket before it met resistance. I think we collected some invaluable information from the attempt. Like, only do it in the proximity of pillows? Onranyan snorted, rubbing his back. He's right, Taron agreed, picking up Threshold. While the experiment didn't work, it wasn't unfruitful. Once we study what happened. I'll leave that to you, gentlemen, I sighed. Keep at it. This was a productive line of research. You're doing good work, I assured them. I'm not going to deny that I was a little disappointed at the result, but I was also determined. Let me know the next time you want to try. I suppose I could have lingered and added my insights to the process, but honestly, Taron is a better thaumaturge than I, and Ulin a better enchanter. I'm better at being in a supervisory role. I walked back to my tower, deep in thought about the experiment, wondering what other means of moving the unmovable I had at my disposal. Along the way, I stopped by the gatehouse and climbed three flights of stairs to Sire Kay's personal quarters. I admit, they made my own hall look shabby by comparison. Kay had a spacious modern hall directly over the gate, allowing a spectacular view of the valley, with Sevendor Town, Sevendor Castle, and Lysgathiel towering in the distance. Sire Kay and Estret's personal chamber was on the eastern side, with smaller rooms for the children. The western end of the floor was my official stronghouse, where the castellan guarded my treasures and funds. An alcove with a recently carved pegboard for keeping track of our expenses and incomes served him as an office. When the weather permitted, Sire Kay liked to take his meals out on the balcony overlooking the road below. That's where I found him, that evening, deep in thought, with his lips clasped firmly around the stem of his pipe as he read the day's reports. So, will we be ready for His Highness's arrival? I asked, when he'd poured me wine. Oh, decidedly, Sire Kay nodded approvingly. We have sufficient notice to order proper victuals, engage in a cleaning program, and otherwise engage the occasion. Be warned, I've approved several additional outlays from the baronial treasury to cover the additional expense. We're hiring more tal and peasants to help, and I've ordered 2 dozen new snowflake banners made, he reported. I thought it would be appropriate. Perfectly, I agreed. I want Tavard to be completely aware that he's in a mageland, and my mageland at that. The goal will be to welcome him, fete him, let him conduct his pilgrimage, and then send him on his way as quickly as possible. A gift is customary from vassal to liege on such an occasion, Sire Kay reminded me. Will you be able to produce something arcane, or should I focus on expensive gaudiness? The arcane, I decided. I'll speak with Master Ulin or one of his assistants about producing something suitable. I just came from the snowflake chamber, where we were doing some advanced experiments. He should have some new and useless enchantments I can throw at the prince. Ah, I wondered at the work you were doing. Kay nodded, both disturbed and relieved. That must have been it. What? I demanded. Well, he began slowly as he studied his wine cup. About half an hour ago, the entire mountain lit up. The stone itself glowed with a pale light. The effect only lasted a few minutes, but it was quite impressive. No doubt I'll be flooded with demands for an explanation. But whatever it was you were doing in there, it had an effect out here, he warned me. You should be wary of that. I try to be wary of everything, I sighed, but it makes sense. Thanks for letting me know. The official response should run something like, the Mage Lord was performing a scheduled assay into the thaumaturgical underpinnings of the local magisphere. Something like that. Sire Kay chuckled. You know, I'm almost starting to understand some of that stuff, he admitted. I hope not. It was pure bullshit. What we were actually doing was trying to figure out how to knock the center point out of the snowflake without getting a cataclysmic response. And were you successful in your experiments? No, Kay, we were not, I sighed heavily. Some days it feels like I'll never get Alia back again. But I think we're making progress. I hope we are. With 3 different schools of magic working on the problem, one of them should be able to free it. I suppose I sounded discouraged and tired, probably because how tired and discouraged I was. But Sire Kay has a knack of knowing just the right thing to say. To progress, he said, holding out his cup for a toast. one foot in front of the other. I couldn't argue with that either. Chapter 7. The Sea Mage Mudrost. Sayaka was not the only one to note the effects of our experiment with the snowflake. Nearly every mage I saw the next day asked me some variation of, "What are you cooking up in the mountain now, Min?" And I got a lot of uneasy looks from the non-magi around the castle. Considering all of the arcane ruckus that they'd experienced since I took ownership of Sevendor, I suppose I couldn't blame them. From the original snow that never melted, that turned a quarter of my domain white, to the scandalous, tawdry Ishi's night, to the waves of magical experiments from myself and others, the poor folk of Sevendor had been tormented by magic almost as much as they'd benefited from it. The intriguing thing to me was actually how well they now accepted it. Having the entire mountain and castle burst into an unearthly glow in the middle of the night was, in context, just not that big of a deal. That was just life in a mage land. We were all getting used to it by now. It wasn't until after breakfast that my page, the lad who dealt with my messages and appointments and such, reminded me that there was a sea mage waiting patiently to speak to me. That's when I started to suspect that mucking around with the snowflake and dangerous thaumaturgy while the sea folk were watching might not have been my wisest decision. "Tell the gentleman that I will meet with him in my private chamber, then bring him to the tower," I instructed the lad. Whatever the strange wizard had to say to me, I preferred to hear it without any interested ears around. My workshop tower was one of the most secure places in Sevendor. When the lad escorted the man to me, he gave a deep bow and introduced himself.
"I am Mudrost, the dry speaker for the Saulibic pod of the Leviathan Kirinsik," he said in a deep but hoarse voice. He was striking, tall, lean and sinewy, his long hair spilling over his shoulders into his beard. He was dressed similarly to a common mariner, with long leather trousers and tunic under a thick woolen cloak, but he wore a broad, elaborately tooled, oil-cured leather bandolier across his chest, filled with the tools of his trade. His thick boots were cunningly designed to keep from slipping on even the slickest of decks, and a broad mariner's knife was stuck in his belt. Mudrost carried a long driftwood staff that had been carefully polished with fish oils and wax until it shone. It was studded with tiny bits of coral, shells, and stones, and glimmered in mage sight with arcane power. He didn't seem to have a witch stone, but the odd shimmering of power the man emitted told me he was a potent wizard without one. "Baron Minelan the Spellmonger," I answered with a smile and a bow. "Wine? I've no sea lord vintages, but—"
"Please," the man assured me politely, "I have had my fill of seawater. I enjoy the landsmen's wines when I am able."
Just to be showy, I conjured a platter from a huckster pocket in one of my rings that bore two silver goblets and a bottle of decent Gilmoran red. Mudrost showed just the barest sign of being impressed as he took a seat and I poured. "So what brings you to my lands, Master Mudrost?" I inquired casually.
"I come seeking an audience with you,"
he explained amiably.
"My pod chanced to range near the shallows of the coast of Castol, as is their way, and tasted something strange and new in the waters. Intrigued, they asked me to investigate. I have been tracking the new factor upriver for near a year now. It leads to this charming little stream, and this magnificent white castle,"
he said, gesturing to my study. "Ah," I realized, "snowstone.
That's what your pod sensed." "So I have come to understand," agreed Mudrost. "Along my journey, I have gathered much has changed in Castal since I took service with the pod. A lack of senses, for one,"
he said wryly. "I didn't think the Seamasters feared the censorate."
"Fear is a strong term. We are wary of their arbitrary rules and reject them. When they cross the Brethren, we strike back. By now they know that we are not to be trifled with,"
he said sternly.
"But it is gratifying to see our dryland cousins finally overthrow their yoke. I have heard that that is largely your doing.
Mine and Duke Rod's, now King Rod's, I pointed out. Since then I've done my best to manage the result.
While defending against a Gervani invasion and a reawakening of the undead in the West, he added. I have done my research, Baron.
Please call me Minolin, I insisted, and I appreciate the interest, but I don't understand it. Why is your pod so intrigued by Snowstone?
The tongues of the nymphs are highly sensitive, especially in ranging season,
Mudrost supplied, not that I understood what he was talking about.
It takes but a small change in the flavor of the seawater to capture their notice. To be candid, Minolin, they were near mad with it.
So the nymphs like my snowstone-flavored river water? I asked, confused. I had virtually no understanding of what he was speaking about. That's never stopped me before.
They were the first who sensed it,
he agreed, after a long and lusty sip of wine.
Was after a storm, when the spring floods bring the finest sweet waters to the sea. The nymphs were ranging along the sandy plains under wave, and began to churn excitedly. And of course their cries caught the attention of their keeper, who in turn notified the Kraytak on duty. When he sent a seeker school in to investigate, they discovered the source of the new flavor. That's when the Hindermen took charge, had the Secretes taste the sweet water, and the old crones went mad too.
I have no doubt, I said, trying to obscure my confusion. Who wouldn't?
Your snowstone,
he explained when he realized I was upriver without a pole,
is new, Minolin. New to the world of Kalidor.
That's what my Alka-Alon friends tell me, I nodded.
More. When the sweet water samples were taken to moisten the coral beds, they grew twice as fast as normal.
That did seem intriguing. I didn't know why, but I was intrigued. Snowstone lowers the local thaumaturgical resistance field of the magisphere, I explained. I don't know how much you know Imperial magic.
I was fairly apprenticed to a landborn sea wizard in an Ultramar,
he informed me.
I held journeyman papers before I was selected by the pod for training. I know how to read. I understand basic thaumaturgy,
he said, with the hint of a snicker in his voice. Excellent. Then you will appreciate the research I've been doing on this material. I proceeded to tell him the story of the raging blizzard that happened the night my son Menalian was born, and the resulting magical transformation of Sevendor. I further explained what we'd discovered about the substance, and made brief mention of some of the unique crystals we'd harvested from vesicles within the rock, without giving too many details.
That makes sense of much of what we theorized,
the sea mage nodded sagely,
and would explain the dramatic effect on the coral beds. I have been empowered by my pod to extend an offer, should I discover the source of the new flavor. Last night, I spoke with my Hinderman, who has had conversation with his fellows. He has authorized me to purchase some of this snowstone for our use.
Now, that's an intriguing proposition, I nodded. As it happens, I do sell the material to my colleagues, who find it invaluable in their enchantments.
I can understand why, he nodded. At what rate do you sell the stone?
I explained the going market rate for snowstone, not counting the free samples I'd given away, or the generous gifts of the stuff I'd made my friends. So, just how much are you looking to buy?
About 3,000 tons,
he said, as casually as if he was discussing eggs at the market.
To start.
My head spun. 3,000 tons of snowstone? That's a lot of rock, I said, dazed.
We would pay fair market price,
he assured me.
I took note of the southern ridge behind the hostel I stayed in last night. It appears to be solid snowstone, and has no settlement upon its steep slopes. Could the stone be harvested from there?
I blinked. Of course. It's easily accessible, and there's no one living there. We could certainly mine that ridge, I agreed. My head began to right itself, and my mind began calculating just how many people I'd need to do so. Hundreds. 3,000 tons would require a lot of labor. Then I stopped. We would, of course, reserve the right to any exotic minerals. I added.
What do you mean?
He asked curiously. We've discovered some crystalline structures of peculiar configuration, I shrugged. I'm a scholar, a thaumaturge. I'd like to study them.
My pod is only interested in snowstone,
Mudrost assured me.
Any pretty pebbles you like, you may keep.
How does your pod plan to pay for the stone? I asked, as I refilled their glasses. I hoped my hand wasn't trembling. So far, snowstone sales were a significant and growing part of my revenue, almost pure profit. The market rate for 3,000 tons was an astronomical amount, the kind of number that only coin brothers can visualize.
Traditionally, transactions between the Vandal and the Landborn are conducted in trade of hard goods, he reasoned. We can pay in gold on delivery, or in other metals, or corals, he added.
That was intriguing, too. Almost all the really good magical corals used in enchantment come to us exclusively through the sea folk. Why don't you make 80% in gold, I suggested magnanimously, and the rest in a variety of other materials.
Such as?
He asked, a bushy eyebrow rising. Surprise me, I shrugged. If you are imperially trained, then you understand the sorts of things I'd like. Give me some of those. I'm sure there are things out beyond the horizon that I don't know about, but might interest me. I'd take that sort of thing as well.
That can be done,
he nodded, grinning widely. I noted two of his teeth had been replaced with corals of different colors.
My pod will be pleased with the bargain.
So how does a sea mage become a
dry speaker?
He supplied.
One has to first be accepted by the lodges of the sea masters, who have watched over the waves since the horizon brought us forth. Some apprentice there as young boys. I submitted myself a year after taking my journeyman's exams. From there, I was put through trials until I was among the most worthy to be offered to the pods which range our coasts. I was fortunate enough to be chosen.
But why? I asked. Not why you were chosen, although I confess I'm curious. But why are you drawn to such an exotic life?
Power, he said instantly. Power and knowledge. The mysteries that lie in the deeps are more compelling than any land-born mage could approach. To be in contact with the ancient minds of our Leviathan mothers is an honored bliss, and to swim above the coral beds, a sublime joy that no mere wizard will understand,
he said reverently.
For this I gave up the pleasures of even the life of a mariner. Those chosen for dry speaking vow to serve 20 years. Some never set foot upon soil until their term is expired. Most die at sea before they ever embrace the dry again.
Well, I suppose that's a legitimate motivation, I said, postponing judgment on the man's choices. I had very good friends who buried themselves in their work to the exclusion of pleasures and pastimes. Taran was one. He was virtually uninterested in the increasing numbers of women, magi, and mundane alike, who were attracted to the thaumaturge. His passion was his work.
It can be a lonely life,
he conceded,
but I have my pod, and during ranging season, they don't hesitate to send me ashore to negotiate with the dryborn, and I shall be expired in a mere 8 years,
he added with a mournful sigh.
It's like losing your entire family. Some can't abide the thought, and plunge themselves into the waves instead of facing it. Once a dry speaker fulfills his term, he is cast out of the pod forever.
To be honest, his life sounded awful to me. I didn't mind non-humans. Some of my best friends weren't human. But to be entirely cut off from your fellow man and surrounded by an array of squishy, chitinous, scaly, and stinky non-humans would be at least 3 kinds of hell. To choose that over beer, bread, and boobs seemed a little mad. He continued to tell me about his life, and while I pitied him for the hardships he'd inflicted on himself, it was clear that it was he who pitied me, my landsman's life. Mudrost was a friendly sort, once you got past his stoic exterior, I found. We finished the bottle in good spirits, shaking hands on our agreement before he left.
I shall take my leave of Sevendor this evening, as my pod has bidden.
He told me they are anxious to receive the snowstone, and wish a full report.
As we are anxious to begin delivering on the bargain, I assured him. I have to make a quick trip myself tonight. I regret that I won't have more time to spend in your company, hearing your tales of the strange sea folk. But Prince Tavard has elected to visit next week, and I am forced to focus my energies on his arrival. Indeed, I received word his envoy arrives tomorrow, I said apologetically.
Ah,
Mudrost nodded as we crossed the great hall to the doorway.
That explains the fantastic displays from your mountain last night. Why, the entire sky above glowed with the power of the spell. I was fascinated by the energies involved in the feat. An arcane entertainment for your liege.
We are always experimenting with new ways to delight and wonder our patrons, I said, letting the obsequious tone of a real spellmonger seep into my voice.
Damn, I'd almost forgotten about the snowflake.
Prince Tavard deserves only the finest from the spellmonger.
I would hate to disappoint him. In truth, I doubt any could be disappointed with such a land,
Mudros told me sincerely.
I never thought I would see the day when magic is used with such abandon and to such purpose. Your folk are prosperous, your city is beautiful, and even the Alka Alon pay court to you,
he said, pointing to the spire of Lesgathiel as I escorted him out of the hall.
You have Karshak and Tal Alon as your servants. I've never seen a land so well run,
he complimented. A credit to my staff, I insisted. I hire good people. I spend a lot of gold. And I've been blessed with good apprentices, I added, as I saw Rudoral peek his head out from behind a tree in the courtyard, then dart back, displaying an unusual shyness.
Usually.
But by all means, if you must depart, let the days before you return be few, I said, citing an old Riverlands proverb.
You can expect to see me again soon,
Mudrost agreed, with one last handshake before he departed. I watched him walk all the way to the gatehouse, the small one for the castle, not the new one that towered overhead behind us, until he was out of sight. That's when the smile left my face.
3,000 tons. 60,000 pounds of pure snowstone.
I was already selling it for what I thought was a hefty sum, and getting eager buyers, but this had the potential to transform Sevendor. I envisioned long lines of ox-drawn wains hauling huge blocks of stone across the land to Sindaria Port as my folk hacked past the topsoil and into the white stone underneath. We could do the actual quarrying magically, of course, which would save time, but that would still employ scores, perhaps hundreds of quarrymen, men who no longer had jobs behind ploughs thanks to the planting ones. A project like this would take years to complete, perhaps lifetimes. And unlike other potential buyers, the seafolk had an outstanding reputation for honesty in their dealings. They didn't seem to understand the concept of cheating from what the law said. Their funds weren't dependent on the price of cotton or wool, expected tribute payments, or the harvest. If they said they would pay, they would pay. Enough to enrich my domain and my entire barony for lifetimes to come. Not a bad price for one small mountain we weren't really using for anything else. I closed my eyes and contacted Lelastian, my expert on Vundel affairs. My sea mage guest just left, I reported, when the Alcan sorceress's mind touched my own. Good news. He didn't ask about the war, or Shurul, or Korbel at all.
That is a relief, Lelastian sighed. I thought it was too early for the Vundel to take note, but with them it's hard to know. So what did he want?
Snowstone.
A lot of it.
Really?
She asked, surprised.
That's all?
That's a lot. I countered. They want 300 tons of it. At fair market prices. That's about a mountain's worth, and enough gold to buy my own kingdom if I wanted.
Do you?
Hells no, I swore. Do you take me for a fool? But this will require a significant investment that will feed my people for years to come, I said, pleased with myself.
Why did the Vundel want snowstone?
She asked suspiciously. I didn't inquire. I realized something about its effect on their coral beds. They were pleased, I added.
The corals are what the leviathans subsist upon, she agreed. The ones in the shallow sea are notoriously damaged and anemic, compared to other seas on Calador. The leviathans who tend them are scrawny, barely able to survive on what is left.
So doubling the growth rate of the coral would be worthwhile.
Doubling? My dear boy, that would be worth just about anything to them. Those corals barely grow anymore.
The ridge corals are millions of years old, and it takes the lifetimes of alkans to see any perceptible growth.
So yes, I can see why the Vandal would be interested in that.
You don't sound particularly hopeful about that, I pointed out.
Oh, it's better than a general eviction, she agreed quickly, but it comes with some new problems. This is the first time I can recall when there was something the Vandal really wanted. Now I think we know why.
Why would snowstone affect the coral growth?
Because the coral system is magical in nature, she explained. Reducing the thaumaturgical resistance around it would allow the cells to metabolize much more quickly, she reasoned. If provided with sufficient minerals and sunlight, then yes, that would accelerate the growth rate, which would allow the shallow sea pods to repopulate.
There seemed to be plenty of them around, I pointed out.
Not as many as there used to be, nor as many as there should be. The sea folk you see now in the shallow sea are a thin remnant of the great fleets of leviathans which used to ply the glorious reef system. The damage was that extensive. Even a modest improvement in their food supply would allow several more pods to split off, and their clippermen to transform into leviathan mothers.
So, maybe that will keep them from throwing us off the world? I offered, hopefully.
It's a good start, she agreed. Let's see how the experiment goes. Speaking of experiments, Lord Eratas and his party have arrived, with 300 more Terra Alon warriors to protect the borders of the Tower.
You sound annoyed by that.
Yes, I am, she admitted.
Permit an old lady a few complaints when her household is disrupted, Minolan. And before you say it,
yes, I understand the necessity. That doesn't mean I enjoy the company.
Did he bring Lady Fallowen with him?
Every sulky, irritating bit of her. She reminds me of my older sister. That is not a positive thing, she added. But they're here and are awaiting your arrival this evening.
I'll be there, I assured her. Thanks for the counsel. I'm hoping we can continue to escape their notice as anything but humble purveyors of shiny rocks.
That's probably in our best interests, she agreed dryly.
When I broke contact, I took a moment to reorient myself and look around at the bustle of activity across the courtyard. Porters were unloading a long string of wagons, bringing ordered provisions to the kitchens, both here and at the gatehouse. Tal Alon drudges were sweeping and scrubbing the exterior of the castle, while Tal Alon gardeners clipped the trees and bushes within the bailey walls. Teams of castle workers erected every tournament tent and campaign canopy we had in storage for the expected overflow of guests, too important to send into town. As I looked around, the distant spire of the Muse Tower caught my eye. Dara could probably fit some more visitors in her new little keep, I reasoned. While the first two stories were designed for storage and supplies, the meandering third story, I knew, was a barracks only a quarter filled with skyriders thus far. Dara had two wings of four birds each, quartered there, with a third stationed in Verone. The barracks story the Karshak constructed had room for three times that many, and comfortably appointed, too. The fourth floor, given over to the craft of falconry, also contained the standard sort of mews. But the fifth floor, the very peak of the tower, still enwrapped with scaffolding as the Karshak toiled to finish it, was the home of her giant birds. There was room for as many as 16 someday, but for now half that number nested in the massive mews. That was where Dara's private apartments were, too, near to her birds. I hadn't seen much of her since I returned from Yule, but it was probably time I paid her new home a visit, especially if I wanted her quartering my vassals. It was her hall, after all.
Master, came a hesitant voice from behind me. At first I thought it was my page, but then I saw it was Ruderal, my youngest apprentice. The normally quiet boy looked more than a little disturbed, which wasn't like him.
What is it, Ruderal?
Word has come from the Dyke Tower, he reported. The ducal envoy is approaching, a party of six. You asked to be alerted, he added politely.
Of course, I said absently. Have the Castellans quarter them in Spellmonger's Hall, and allow him and his party to rest and recuperate from his long journey. Inform them that I shall attend them in the morning.
You have plans for the evening, Master?
The boy inquired. I need to go fix Riff's wedding, I confided, especially if we want to see it occur on Brigger's Day, with all due ceremony.
He was quite excited about it the last time he was here,
the boy agreed, but there was still something bothering him, I could tell. What is it about the ducal envoy that has you so nervous, lad? I asked, as kindly as I could. I've met the man. He's a horrible boor, overly ambitious, and he tends to shout everything, but he's a harmless fool. Or is it the prince's visit you fear? I asked, concerned. Ruderal was a little moody, thanks to his talent for reading other people's enneagrams constantly, but he had developed a fairly thick skin about letting such things affect him personally.
Oh, I look forward to seeing a prince, Master, Ruderal assured me. I've never seen one before.
You are not missing much, I sighed. So, if it isn't the prince's visit, what is it? Do you not have enough lessons to keep you busy?
Not at all, Master, he said, horrified.
I had him working daily with the court wizard or one of the other magi in the castle when I couldn't spare my attention. By all accounts, the boy was an ideal student, picking up on his lessons even faster than Dara did, and far faster than Tyndall ever had.
No, it's just... Who was that wizard you were talking to earlier?
He asked curiously.
Him?
A sea mage, I replied, an emissary from the sea folk on an errand of business.
Why?
Is it the Vandal, you fear? Ruderal swallowed nervously and shook his head.
I've never met one, though I've seen their pictures and statues often enough in Solishaven, but they never come to an ultramar, thanks to the rocks in the bay. It's too shallow for them, even though there are lots of yummy sandflies and spider claws on the shore.
Then what is it? I demanded, getting a little impatient.
That man, Master?
He continued after a thoughtful pause.
I read his enneagram. I didn't mean to, really, but there was something about it, he reported warily. Something that made me.
I paid attention, then. Ruderal's skill at reading the arcane symbolism of a particular person's self-awareness had been vital in the past. I was still getting used to the boy's almost preternatural understanding of what other people were thinking and doing, but he still surprised me on a regular basis.
What is it?
I repeated. Does he mean us harm? Is he not what he says he is?
No, no, Master, he said, shaking his head. Nothing like that. He's honest, more honest than Lord Mayor Bannermore, he explained.
He doesn't mean you or Sevendor harm. He's uncomfortable this far inland, but part of him is enjoying it.
Then what is it?
I asked for the third time.
Master, I think that man was my father.
Chapter 8. The Reluctant Bride. Lord Eritas was waiting for me at Arth Nuafa, the Tower of Refuge, with his daughter, Lady Fallowen, and a few score of his people. All of them were in their humanish forms, and many were armed and armoured in the human style the Terra Alon were beginning to adopt. Others were dressed in robes and gowns cut in exotic fashion. I was gratified to see Terra Alon warriors patrolling both the perimeter of the settlement and the tower itself. While there were no traditional battlements, the tree folk had improvised merlons and such out of stones from the ruins. There were more than enough of them to repel a raid the size of the one the Enshadowed sent at Yule. The Terra Alon troops were quartered in an unused corner of the settlement, but spellsingers, in their natural forms, were encouraging three trees to grow in an equilateral triangle. From what I understood, the trees would eventually become the kind of hidden tree forts that the Alka Alon, particularly the Avalanti kindreds, preferred. I was escorted up to the second-floor balcony, an area of the tower I'd yet to see. Lelastian was there, also in her humanish form, looking irritated. Lord Eritas was looking stoic and stubborn, and Fallowen was looking resigned and depressed.
"Thank you for meeting with me here,"
I began, without ceremony, as I hung my mantle and my hat on a convenient protrusion.
I still wasn't terribly familiar with Alka-Alon architecture, and there were a lot of elements I didn't know the use for. The thing looked ornate and floral, so naturally I used it as a hat rack. I am here on behalf of my vassal, Sire Rife.
We know,
Fallowen said, deliberately. He has my blessing to hold the wedding at Brigger's Day in Sevendor. The Prince of Castelshar will be in attendance, and it would be an auspicious occasion to mark the alliance between our peoples with your union.
So soon?
Fallowen asked, dazed. Soon, my lady, I answered. It has been near 2 years since you pledged your troth. The Terra-Alon encampment is nearly complete, from what I understand. Your own folk are gathering for the effort, I reminded her.
I've done 20 transgenic spells just today,
Nelastian agreed wearily.
There seem to be plenty of volunteers, particularly amongst the Avalanti.
We are gaining strength,
agreed Lord Eritas, his voice sounding like a deep bronze bell. I have hundreds of Terra-Alon warriors, Avalanti and Vassarotti both, who have taken the oaths I devised and the form of our allies. Once they gain their forms here and adjust to them, they are sent to one of several camps to train in the arts of war.
I will not have my home turned into an army camp, Lelastian said distastefully. It is a place of healing.
Nor would we begrudge your hospitality. While I was uneasy with your parole, Elre, I concede that our situation requires many unconventional responses. Athnoafa is a place of healing. Our new outpost in Sevendor shall serve as our training ground,
Eritas assured her, in a tone that told me it was not the first time he'd made the argument.
There the Terra-Alon shall study with the Humani and arm themselves more completely.
A feat that would be facilitated, should the marriage to Sire Rife inspire the proper desire among my folk, I pointed out with what I hoped was tact.
There is much excitement about the wedding, I added.
Evidentially,
Fallowen said icily. My lady, I said politely, did you not enter into this union of your own free will? What is the show of reluctance you display?
Sire Rife is a fine knight,
she replied curtly. There seemed to be much she was not saying. I looked toward our hostess.
Lady Fallowen's reluctance is due to the insecurity she feels becoming intimate with Sire Rife,
Nelastian said wryly. Though I have explained the mechanics of human reproduction, including the usual expectations of a marital relationship, she balks at some of the finer matters she finds unpalatable.
Such as?
I asked, wondering if I needed to summon Pentandra. This was really more her type of thing.
Such as submitting to his orders and deferring to his judgment in all things? How do your women endure such humiliation?
She demanded angrily. The more of your marital customs I study, the more I wonder how your species has survived at all.
We're good at brewing and distilling, I shrugged. The rites of Trig are fairly straightforward, my lady. And while it is true that they demand a wife submit to her husband's judgment and obey his orders, they also demand his fair and just treatment of you.
Fair, she scoffed. Just. Should he so deign, spellmonger, he may elect to confine me to my chamber, and I'm just supposed to obey him, even if I disagree with him?
She demanded angrily. There are ample provisions in the sacrament for a wife to respectfully declare her objections, if her goddess-given wisdom deems her husband's orders harmful or demeaning, I pointed out. You may even appeal to the Temple of Trig's judgment if he mistreats you, and no vassal of mine would dare ignore a judgment from the temple on such an important matter, I added warningly.
You think I fear Sire Rife would beat me?
Scoffed Fallowen. When the man has the legal authority under your insane system to forbid his wife to attend the market without his leave, a beating would be a welcome alternative to such confinement.
I assure you, my lady, my wife Alia finds little confinement in her role, I pointed out. While Sire Rife is admittedly from the rural nobility, I cannot foresee a case where a man so smitten with his bride would consider such extremes.
You ask me to depend upon his love, she said, shaking her head.
I am asking you to take the same risks with your heart and your life that any human maid would, entering into marriage, I said briskly. I started to realize that her objections weren't entirely rooted in our strange Humani customs. They were starting to sound like the sort of misgivings many a maiden has had when the reality of a marriage commitment started to set in. I am no human maiden, she said proudly. I am a noble of the House of Eritas of the Versaroti kindred. My line extends 10,000 years back to our coming to Calador.
A line whose leadership you would have inherited had you not convinced me to leave Anthatiel to fight another day, her father reminded her. This was the price of the sacrifice of my honour. It was you who begged me to reconsider an alliance with the Humani. It was you who encouraged me to mount an opposition to the abomination. Yet now you drag your feet when the day comes to fulfil your honourable pledge, he chided.
I am not dragging my feet, Fallowen said, sighing heavily. I am merely concerned that Sire Rife and I will not be compatible, she admitted, that my tenure as his wife will be something to endure.
Lelastian snorted and rolled her eyes. There is no woman on Calador who does not have doubts before they come to the altar, Fallowen. You tremble with anxiety, just as all brides do. But let me assure you, Humani and Elka alone can enjoy a robust and blissful union together in these forms, she said, gesturing to herself. I've done so myself, dozens of times, back on Perwin.
What?
Fallowen asked, scandalized.
Oh, don't be such a prude, dismissed the old Alkan with a wave. Do you honestly think that you're the first Alkan woman to be curious? Perwin was a very sophisticated place back during the colonization, and that curiosity was shared by plenty of adventurous Humani. And you have no idea how boring it can be in residency.
Lady Lelastian,
Fallowen's face was blushing darkly. I assure you, the experience was both novel and rewarding for all parties. The old Alkan lady snickered fondly. There are spots in these bodies that—
Did you have a point, Elray?
Lord Eritas demanded uncomfortably. I could sympathize. No father wants to hear about his daughter's marriage bed.
My point is that this is nothing more but a failure of your own ego, she said, matter-of-factly. You advocate an alliance with the Humani and openly admire their race. Your fascination with them is well known, even to me in my prison. You volunteered to be among the first to undertake the transgenic enchantment to give you your Terra Alon form. You've adopted Humani fashions and behaviors with stylish abandon. But now you have to face your fascination, Lelastian said, with a wicked gleam in her eye. You have come face to face with the reflection of yourself, not as an Alkan maiden, but as a Terra Alon, about to cross the frontier of interspecies relations in the most intimate of all possible ways. You have to evolve, she said, searching for a Narasi term. Technically it was an imperial root with a Narasi style, but close enough. You have to make the decision to commit not just to a Humani man, who has declared his undying and deeply abiding love and infatuation with you, but to your own sense of self. Are you an Alkan maid with a scandalously perverse fascination with an alien species? Or are you the bridge to something different, something new in Calador, emerging of Humani and Alkan at the most primal level possible? The accusation made Fallowen blanch uncomfortably. Lord Eritas folded his hands on the table as his daughter struggled with her sense of identity. His position was clear. I cleared my throat. Perhaps it would be helpful to exercise another Narasi rite, the Maiden's Vigil.
I'm not terribly familiar with that one, confessed Lelastian.
When I got locked in here, your folk were still waging their terror campaign, devouring the sophisticated civilization of the Majocrasair.
I ignored the jab. Under the laws of Trig regarding such matters, if the bride is reluctant or has misgivings, she may retire to a place of seclusion with her closest confidants and a priestess of Trig for a period of reflection, self-criticism, and self-examination before she comes to temple. The vigil can last anywhere from 3 days to, well, to just before the wedding. But the usual result is either appearance at the altar or the taking of holy orders, I added apologetically.
Married? Or submit to some insane priesthood?
Fallowen asked, her eyes wide.
What kind of barbarian savages are you? There are enough extenuating circumstances in this case that I'm certain a reasonable third option could be found, I said slowly, wondering how persuading a bride with cold feet to actually make it to the wedding had become part of my duties.
I want to exercise the maiden's vigil,
Fallowen declared, in a near panic. I will have Sister Bemia make the arrangements, I nodded slowly. I trust she is an acceptable officiant. You know her, after all, I pointed out, and you can name your own confidants to accompany you and advise you.
Varen and Ithalia. Damn it! Somehow I know Ithalia is behind this.
Behind what? Asked her father. Your own reluctance? Perhaps the promise you made me was rashly done, my daughter, but I take you on your honour. Do what you must to convince yourself. But the vow was freely made. Do not invoke your pride in your line and your kindred if you are so quick to dishonour it by your deeds.
To that, Fallowen had no answer. She lowered her eyes and sighed.
It will only be for a few decades, dear,
Lelastian comforted her. I think you will find it far more enjoyable than you anticipate.
What if I cannot fulfil my duties to produce... to have babies?
She asked, her face now draining.
Oh, there should be no issue with that,
Lelastian assured her. When we designed these forms, we used only the finest physical specimens of Humani to base them upon, and then we made certain improvements to make them more compatible with our Alcan enneagrammatic architecture. The only differences between your current form's physiology and human maids are in your limbic and neurological systems. Your reproductive organs are as healthy and ripe as any young Humani woman's. There should be no impediment to having children.
Well, that's a relief,
Fallowen said unconvincingly. I am happy to offer Arth Nuafa for the vigil, Lelastian continued. There are dozens of hectares of forest within the bounds, and plenty of scenic, inspirational sights which may help your mind find balance.
Thank you, Elway, Lord Eratas nodded, as to the wedding itself. You mentioned a warrior prince would be in attendance. Prince Tavod of Castal.
He was as ignorant of human politics as I was, Alcan, but he was starting to learn.
Indeed, somewhat of a surprise, but his grace sees fit to grace us with his presence on Briggers Day, on a pilgrimage to the Everfire.
Such an auspicious witness to the union between our two peoples would bode well for future relations.
Yet we cannot have a Humani of higher rank in attendance, Eratas said, troubled. Damn! That means we have to trot out Alma Servala again.
Lelastian groaned. That's the fellow who was at Rad's coronation, wasn't he? I recalled.
Yes.
He's technically a member of the council, but in truth, Prince Alma Servala of the House of Felus Samus is a vapid figurehead, a remnant of a once important political dynasty that, for reasons no one can properly explain, still lingers as titular monarch over this realm. I could tell Eratas held a certain animosity for the Alcan.
He's an idiot, parlous and pretentious. Worse, he's a horrible boor, with none of the redeeming virtues of his sires. Most of them were at least aware of the current political situation, even if they didn't participate. Alma Servala sits in his ancient palace in his idyllic glade, suffering the delusion he commands any but his immediate servants.
It was his ancestors who built Castabriel, the original Alcan city, not the Humani shanty town that sits there now, and they who bungled their rule so badly that they were forced to turn all actual decisions over to the council about 3,000 years ago. Since then they have been a royal pain in the council's arse,
Lelastian supplied. She so enjoyed gossip, I was noticing.
The closest he comes to power is whatever he can wheedle out of his niece, Micrethiel, who doesn't hold him in as high esteem as I.
Eratas sniffed wryly.
She doesn't forgive him or his father for their original support of the human settlement. Yet he will do as he is bid, he added sternly. If the council requests his presence in Sevendor, he shall be there.
Thank you,
I nodded, although inside I started to panic about adding yet another unstable element to an already chaotic and potentially disastrous occasion. I'm certain his grace will appreciate the honour of the prince's attendance.
It is a small price to pay,
the Alcan lord insisted, to gather the strength to strike back against the abominations. Then I bear good news, I smiled. I'm planning a little raid soon, against the forces of the enemy, and no mere strike against an outpost. I want to raid the cursed fortress of Ulam Seheri. The mention of his former home's dark new name was more than enough to capture Lord Eretas's interest.
You have my attention, spellmonger,
the Alcan Lord said, leaning closer.
Tell me more.
I wasn't trying to hurry the long-overdue meeting between me and Lord Eretas, but once we established the problem, and Falloen committed to a course of action, the rest of the evening was mere pleasantries. Pleasantries I grew impatient with. But even ancient Alcan lords get tired, and eventually Eretas excused himself and his daughter, informing us he planned to enjoy the stars from the rise near the center of the compound. I was thankful to see him go. Not because I disliked the man, but because I had important matters to discuss with Lelastian. We had a bit of an issue with our plan to secure a gemstone of sufficient complexity to carry the handmaiden, I told her, as she led me upstairs to a quiet part of the tower. Apparently, the snowflake doesn't like it when you try to stuff it into a huckster pocket. I thought the whole mountain would collapse for a minute.
Now why would you want to do something like that? She demanded, as she led me to Alia's quarters.
To convince the snowflake not to act quite so much as a malapar, I answered. At least, that was the theory. If we could remove it from this reality, even for a moment, then perhaps we could strike the center point from it before it noticed. Only, it noticed. She grunted.
You're lucky you weren't all killed.
Malapars are nothing to approach lightly. You are as arrogant and incautious as your sires, she chided. Is that so terrible? I asked, not expecting an answer. We only have a few score decades on this world at best. Caution and humility are for the long-lived. She stopped, her human form turning on her slippered feet. Not at all. It's one of your species' more endearing qualities. It allows you to progress far faster than my own race ever did. It also tends to start wars, blow things up, and sink perfectly good islands, if you aren't careful.
So noted, I shrugged. Why would you have to put the thing inside a huckster pocket in the first place? She added, continuing down the corridor.
That seems rash. It seems to me that if you merely want to separate the center point, you just need to affect that section accordingly, using some thaumaturgical medium to alter its inherent vibration enough to create an imbalance in the field. If the imbalance is great enough, she reasoned, then the snowflake itself will push the center point away, given enough encouragement. It was my turn to stop.
You know, I said slowly, considering the implications of her suggestions, that just might work,
or at least be a solid enough premise on which to base a more thorough approach. Let me think on it.
You do that, she said, as she brought me to the door of Alia's chamber.
She was sleeping inside, one of the two nuns who I paid to attend her sitting in a chair near her bedside. She looked peaceful, almost childlike, under the blankets. The nun realized who I was and stood up immediately.
Shh,
I said, putting my finger to my lip.
I just wanted to check on her while I was here.
I explained in a whisper.
How does she fare?
She eats most heartily, Mage Lord,
the young novice assured me with a continuous nod.
She seems in good spirits, but she's easily confused and can get frightened.
But her health is good. Her physical health.
Oh, aye, Mage Lord,
she nodded.
The elves take wondrous care of her. Of all of us.
I nodded absently and stroked Alia's face gently. I couldn't help it. Here, asleep, she looked almost the same as my wife did before I took her to Greenflower. I allowed myself a few tortured, aching moments of quiet self-pity and regret before I dried my eyes and left her to sleep in peace.
Was that really healthy?
Lelastian accused.
I needed it,
I admitted. I needed to remind myself why I was going through all of this, for whom I was going through all of this.
Your children aren't your inspiration? She asked, curious.
It would likely be best for my children if I took the counsel of locking her away in an abbey somewhere, having my marriage annulled, and finding them a fresh mother.
They are young enough so that they would recover, it is said.
But I'm not here for them, I declared, as we headed back to the main hall. I am here for her. She sacrificed her mind, her life, for me, to avenge a crime done to me.
out of love alone. I cannot rest until I have done everything I can to restore her.
You poor, pathetic, ephemeral creatures,
the Lastian sighed, sounding amused. You live so briefly, yet love so intensely. No wonder you breed so prolifically, she added. But such desperate lives lead to such amazing accomplishments, and such profound commitments. If I had to give up everything I've gotten since I met her to be with her, the real her, again, I answered after some thought, I would not hesitate, nor ever regret the cost. I don't doubt it, she said, a small smile on her face. Nor do I doubt that you will find a way. You are damned determined once you have committed yourself. How do you feel Eritas took the news of the impending raid, I asked, as we left the tower and entered the cool late winter night. Spring was just around the corner, no more than a few more weeks away. The snow here had already faded to frozen banks in the shadowed lee of ruins and hills. It crunched under my boots as we walked.
He was eager, the Lastian said, her manner changing. Passing eager. I'll be honest, seeing him there at the table tonight, in his larger form, he reminded me of the great warriors of old. Oh, not that I remember them, she demurred. I'm old, I'm not ancient, but Eritas has a regal bearing and a single-mindedness that harkens back to our own ancient warrior princes.
He's going to need that kind of fortitude to assail Olam Saheri, I observed. Hopefully rage and revenge will be enough to carry him through, and I'm counting on his folks' knowledge of the geography of the place to help get us in and out. That's going to be essential.
Eritas is a proud Alcan and stubborn, but he will do whatever it takes to reconquer his stolen city. He's helpful in another way, too, she added. He's one of the few who had access to the ghost rock under the city. He has plumbed the depths within hundreds of times. No one knows the intricacies of the technique better.
I was wondering how I was going to handle that, I sighed. Once we get in, assuming we get all the way down to the ghost rock, we're not going to have a lot of time before Korbal responds in force. Not the ideal time for necromantic experimentation.
The technique itself is not complicated, but Eritas built an elaborate security system around its access to restrict the foolish from dabbling with those potent forces. He's one of the few who can penetrate it.
Then I'll need his assistance transferring the Enneagram to the stone, assuming I can secure that.
I yawned unexpectedly. You're tired, Lelastian noted. Go home and get some rest.
I think we've convinced our reluctant maiden to consider her commitment, and Eritas is pleased with that. You even got him to get our slothful prince off his regal butt and make an appearance. You've done a good night's work here, Menelan. I do wonder how an actual marriage between the two will work. Can she put aside her preconceptions and prejudices enough to appreciate Rife? And can he go beyond his romantic notions of the Alka Alon to understand Fallowan's more sophisticated perspective? It shall be interesting to watch.
Oh, she'll overcome her misgivings,
the Lastian assured me. There weren't very many actual marriages between species back in Perwin, just a lot of curious naughtiness. But the few that did occur weren't any more or less tumultuous than either Alcan or human marriages. Apart from the scandal in Alcan circles, they weren't even particularly remarkable. My people didn't object, I asked, surprised.
Your ancestors were quite open-minded, refreshingly so. There was never any serious objection to such unions on Perwin, all part of the great colonial experiment. You didn't get pig-headed and barbaric until after you sank the place. By then, interspecies mating was a rarity. My people withdrew from yours and let you sink into ignorant squalor, and ignorant squalor just isn't particularly attractive. I think that is as much a factor in her reluctance as anything else.
It should be an interesting experiment, I agreed. Then I yawned again. I must get some sleep. The prince will be here in a week, and I have a lot of ignorant squalor yet to contend with.
Chapter 9. The Missing Mountain. The morning after visiting the Tower of Refuge, I steeled myself for the inevitable meeting with the ducal envoy as I ploughed my way through a potato and ham casserole at the high table in the great hall. I'd risen late, mage lord's prerogative, and most of the hall was empty at the end of breakfast,
so I didn't see many people before my page approached me, a look of fear and wonder in his eyes. "Good morning, Terence. Messages today?"
"Mage Lord," he began, "I have to know. What did you do with it?"
"What did I do with what?" I asked, confused.
"Rudy says it wasn't you, but you're the spellmonger, aren't you? So it has to be you. No one else could do that."
"Do what?" I asked, growing frustrated.
"I don't care what Rudy says," he said,
referring to Ruderal, my young apprentice. The two boys were friends, I knew.
"I know you could do it if you wanted to, but where did it go? That's what I want to know."
I took a deep breath. "What I want to know is what you are talking about." He looked at me as if I'd played a joke on him, or was testing him. I was just confused as hell.
"The mountain?"
"What mountain?" I asked, my sense of anxiety growing.
"The one that isn't there anymore," he said,
as if reminding me of something obvious. "Show me," I demanded at once, my eyes growing wide. The lad led me outside into the inner bailey and walked with me to the outer wall, near the court wizard's tower. The moment I mounted the rise before the wall, my eye was drawn instantly to the deeply disturbing vision. When you are used to something being there and it isn't, your mind gets bruised, I've decided, but there was no denying the truth of what my eyes were seeing. I just couldn't believe it. One of my mountains was missing. To say it was disconcerting is the greatest of understatements. Mountains tend to be fairly permanent fixtures on the horizon, and walking outside to the sight of one of them not there anymore disturbed me at a fundamental level. The entire peak was gone, a slice of the ridge taken neatly away from its fellows like a slice of cake. I could see the smooth white cliffs of the peak on the other side. The depression where the mountain had once lain was at least 80 feet below the surface. From where I was standing, I could just see across the void and into the land beyond. The resulting gap was almost a quarter mile wide. I could see the fertile lands of my vassal domain, Hossendor, through the new gap. And there was something glittering in the afternoon sunshine at the bottom of the new gigantic white pit. "Summon my wizards," I ordered my page, my voice hoarse and shaking. "I have need of them."
"Which ones, Mage Lord?"
the boy asked. He was starting to realize that I wasn't responsible for the missing mountain.
"All of them,"
I said in a near whisper, as my mind tried to accommodate the novelty of this new view. "I'm going to need them all." Sire Kay looked out across the vast, smooth expanse of exposed bedrock below his head, shaking in disbelief.
"Minelan,"
he said hoarsely, not using a title. That's how shaken he was.
"What did you do?"
"I sold some snowstone," I managed, my eyes trying to encompass the volume of stone the sea folk had purchased.
"So it appears," Zagor nodded. "I do hope you received payment," he said. Non-payment was a frequent complaint of spellmongers.
"Let's go find out," Bannermore said,
nodding toward the centre of the quarry, where there seemed to be some building or other.
"Magesight says that is a big pile of glittery something."
"It could be anything."
"It's not dog shit. Dog shit doesn't glitter," Bannermore grunted.
"It could be dangerous," Zagor said.
"Just getting down there will be dangerous,"
Olmec pointed out. "Minelan, you realize what will happen in a few months, once we hit the rainy season, don't you?"
"I get a new, really large moat,"
I sighed. "So someone fetch 100 feet of rope. Let's go see what a mountain of snowstone is worth these days." As it turned out, quite a lot. I didn't want to wait around for rope or the inevitably difficult climb down to the floor. That wasn't greed or ambition speaking, or even an unquenchable quest for the unknown. In fact, I was panicking mightily about what had to have been a massive miscalculation. When the Vundle's sea mage emissary offered to buy that much snowstone, I figured that it would be my people who harvested and delivered it over a period of years. It had seemed an outstanding deal when I'd negotiated it, but apparently the sea folk had other ideas. As soon as the agreement was concluded, they took delivery on the spot. Magically. I had to get down to the center of the quarry first and see if what I'd lost was worth what I'd gained.
We lowered a rope down to the smooth floor of the trench, and one by one we climbed down. Master Loiko was already detailing soldiers to patrol the edge of the gap and keep back the curious and alarmed people of Sevendor. Saya Kay was assuring everyone that the spellmonger was dealing with the matter. That seemed to soothe everyone on the lip of the cliff. Except for me. I was going mad inside my head. There was nothing moving down there, no hidden enemies, no obvious traps, just two piles of stuff. The larger was a pyramid, the smaller a pile. When I slid to the floor of the pure white trench, the pyramid demanded my inspection first. It towered into the air almost three stories above me, a perfect tetrahedron of spheres. As I got closer, I realized that the entire structure was made of spheres, each the size of a child's head. The bottom four levels were solid gold. I stumbled and fell to my knees with the realization. The two levels above that were silver, and beyond that, they changed color and texture with frequency as they diminished with each level. The top, I could not even see the top sphere from this angle. Just the four levels of gold, however, assuming that the levels were flat sheets, solid throughout, represented more gold, I was certain, than currently existed in the kingdom. I was quite literally the richest human being anywhere. While the magnitude of my fortune was still keeping my mouth moving with no sound coming out of it, the other wizards began to arrive. The scene that followed was a wild chorus of oaths and disbelief. Even quiet Olmeg was moved to profanity. Bannermore, I don't think I'll record his reaction. There weren't a lot of words involved, and honestly, I'm not sure the words exist to describe it. Sephistaran, I said quietly. How much? Just the gold, to start. I suppose it was unfair of me to throw the boy in the deep part of the river, but I needed answers fast. I almost hoped those spheres were mere hollow shells. Past a certain point, great wealth is as much of a curse as great poverty. There was no hollow sound when Sire Kay wrapped the lowest sphere with his knuckles and pronounced it solid. Solid gold. Festaren got a faraway look in his eye, and for a moment I thought I'd broken the boy. But a few harried moments later, while Dara looked on, concerned, he returned an answer. 524 ounces, he finally sighed, for each sphere. Approximately 8,100 spheres on the first level alone, which makes the first level worth over 4 million ounces of gold, over 3 million on the second. Each of those spheres is worth enough to purchase a barony, Bannermore realized, his eyes glazed over. Do you want a barony? Olmeg asked, surprised.
Hells no! Bannermore spat. I work for a living. I just provided some context for value.
That means you could buy every barony in the five duchies, then, Master Loiko offered.
This is more gold than anyone should have, I said, shaking my head.
Not to mention the silver. And what are all of those spheres in the upper level?
A fortune of fortunes, Bannermore nodded. More than any man could spend in 100 lifetimes. Worth enough gold to permanently destabilize the economy.
What's this over here?
Asked Ruderal, his voice filled with excitement and boyish curiosity. He was the only one not obsessed with the unimaginable fortune I'd just acquired. He'd wandered past the pyramid and over to a pile of debris on the other side. I joined him, curious what else the Vandal emissary had done to my land. It proved to be a mound of crystals, a pile as wide as a house and as tall as my waist at its peak. I recalled the sea mage, who Ruderal didn't want me to pursue, for reasons he would not explain, agreeing that any crystals found during excavation shall be the property of the spellmonger. The Vandal had adhered to the letter of the agreement. All of the hidden vesicles of crystals within my missing mountain were no doubt now piled up here. While that spared me years, perhaps lifetimes, of prospecting, it presented me with a far more pressing problem. Indeed, this entire episode was a far more pressing problem. The implications of what had happened were echoing in my mind. Not merely the reaction of my neighbors and my overlords to this sudden change in geography, but the importance of what happened in interspecies politics. I struggled to breathe.
Let's start getting all of this
cleaned up, I said hoarsely, as quickly and as efficiently as possible. I'll speak to the Karshak about helping, I added, looking at the spheres of gold and silver that were far too heavy for a man to lug. Even with magic there would be some lugging to do. Spheres are not the most efficient shapes to deal with on dry land. Master Loiko, if you will cast some obscuring spells, and Sir Festaren, if you could go fetch some supply rods from the castle, I think we can probably get this cleaned up before anyone notices. And no one breathes a word of this to anyone. I need your assurances as gentlemen of Sevendor. I looked around and made certain to receive a verbal assent from each of them, an attention that I hoped proved a measure of how serious I took this oath. I hope it worked. The rest of the day was spent in a state of continuous crisis. Troops screened the people back from the site while we worked, far enough back so that they could not see our industry. But there was no disguising the sudden change in the skyline. You could peer through the gap clear into Hosendor now, like a magnificent tapestry. Crowds assembled beyond the barricades to do just that, and speculate on what, in Nine Hells, the spellmonger had done now. I was asking that same question myself.
Well, this was an unmitigated disaster, Onranyan remarked as he poured wine for us all in my study that evening.
The treasure was now entombed deep within the recesses of my mountain castle, guarded by the Karshak. The crystals were stored in a chamber carved near to the Snowflake's chamber, where it was hoped they wouldn't do anything unnatural. Once we got organized, the work flowed smoothly, and the last of the valuable debris in the giant depression was removed by dusk. That's when the impromptu council erupted. I didn't call it. It just sort of happened. People started showing up in my study and started pouring wine.
It also made Minilan the richest man in the world, grumbled Bannermore.
Jealous? Asked Sister Bemia, the castle chaplain. She'd been brought in to help soothe the jittery nerves of the population.
It does take me out of the running,
Bannermore grinned. He mostly had a good-natured approach to his avarice. After a lifetime of hard wandering, he enjoyed being a rich man. He didn't need to be the richest.
Min, why in the name of all the gods did you take the sea folk's bargain?
Asked Master Olmeg, shaking his head.
They are not to be refused, Zagor said, shaking his head. Even the fair ones fear them, and rightly so.
Maybe if you were in a coastal fief, snorted Bannermore, but we're hundreds of miles from a seaport. The sea folk's reach can extend well beyond the coasts, I explained. They made a polite request at market prices. I had thought that it would be a gradual process using human labor and industry, a long-term project, not a market-day purchase. But had I refused, the next offer was not likely to be as generous, I sighed.
That I cannot argue, Aranyan said sympathetically, and if you want to get technical, they dramatically overpaid for it. But what the Vandal want, the Vandal get. It was a disaster, he repeated, but unavoidable.
How in three hells did they even know about it? Asked Sister Bemia.
Downstream, Olmeg said, as he lit his long pipe. The Keta empties into the Bontal and thence to the sea. The sea folk could taste the change in the outflow into the shallow sea, I expect.
You are right, I agreed. That's what the sea mage told me.
I'm curious as to what they want with it, Bannermore said, and if they want more.
They just bought about 10% of my unique inventory, I complained. I don't think I could afford to sell them more. I'll run out of mountains eventually. But let's quit the speculation, as entertaining as it is, and focus on the immediate crisis.
I don't see a crisis, Bannermore declared. I see a 2-day journey to Hosendor, Hosley and Kest, suddenly cut to a half-day. That's an opportunity.
Only if you can get across that gap, Lord Mayor,
Sire Kay pointed out. That implies a bridge to be built. That gully will quickly fill come the next rainy season. It does provide a spectacular defense, however, he added, his military mind engaged. Perhaps a wall built on the far side with a tower protecting the bridge across it?
Yes, it will be a wonderful moat, I dismissed, irritated.
And by all means, let us make building a bridge and fortifying it a priority. Because in case it hasn't escaped your attention, suddenly missing a mountain
is going to attract a lot of other people's attention, particularly in the wake of the Mage War. If I'm the kind of mage who can likely make mountains disappear, well, that makes folks nervous. Some of the potentially nervous folks were already here. I'd had to send apologies to the ducal envoys while I dealt with the day's crisis. I explained I was detained by construction matters. It wasn't really a lie.
You mean the court?
Sayake asked. I mean Prince Tavard in particular, I nodded. He's already not an admirer of mine. He's feeling complacent and powerful with his little sister locked away. While this isn't a direct threat to his rule, he's going to feel compelled to do something if it becomes a problem. We have to prepare for that. Any suggestions? I asked, a bit desperately. We did a surprisingly good job hammering together a strategy that evening. The Karshak would immediately devote their resources to building a bridge and wall, while sketching up plans for a defensive emplacement to guard the new moat. It could be made passable by wagon within weeks, they assured me. The hard defences would take much longer. But with Master Eritas's terror alone, encamped just to the northeast of the gap, there was little danger in surprise attack. That only left 1,000 other majorly important details unaccounted for. What would I do with that much gold, for instance, or that much magical coral? What were those other spheres made from? And what would I do with that many unique crystals, touched by snowstone and bearing the possibility of new potencies? It was enough to inspire a man to drink, which is just what I did that night. 2 small bottles of local spirits. Ruderal finally poured me into the cot in my workshop, determining I was too far gone by that late hour to make it across the yard to my hall. The next morning, hungover and feeling wretched, the magnitude of my problems was still there. It was enough to make a man doubt the efficiency of drink. The next morning, I made meeting with the ducal envoy a top priority, inviting Sire Dasuos and his aide, Lord Ustal, at my personal hall just outside of the castle. Putting him off even a day was problematic, but I figured an excellent breakfast on the balcony of my hall, overlooking my beautiful little vale, would be a good place to make up for the slight. I wore a new outfit for the occasion, a long knee-length tunic with wide sleeves in Sevendor green, with a surcoat resembling the style the Riverlords favoured. Only I had the collar cut in Ramiran fashion, in a deep V, revealing the amulet in which I carried my Lona Witchstone. There was an enchantment on the exterior that emitted a pale green glow, but that was merely for effect. Sire Dasuos, wonderful to see you again, I called to him, as my valet, Staxid, let him up from the door. The young knight was dressed in a fine cotton surcoat over his expensive mail. He wore an irritated expression on his clean-shaven face, one mirrored by the smaller man behind him. Spellmonger! He called loudly as he mounted the stairs. Indeed, Sire Dasuos said just about everything loudly. It was easily his most distinguishable characteristic. What is the meaning of keeping us waiting an entire day after our arrival?
My apologies, my lord, I said soothingly. I had urgent business to attend to. Wizard business, I added without further elaboration.
Hiding the sudden disappearance of a mountain just outside your door counts as wizard business.
I trust your journey was pleasant.
Enough, he conceded, and I cannot believe that the same vagabond mage who came to Wilderhall in borrowed clothes 5 years ago has produced all of this, he added grudgingly. Truly, I underestimated you.
You would be neither the first nor the last, let us hope, I said, as I ushered them to their chairs.
2 Tal Alon maids, Sunflower and Tulip, served ale and food, respectively. Their small hands had been meticulously manicured, and the hair on their hands and wrists had been covered by a cloth sleeve. They even wore the Tal Alon equivalent of wimples over their sturdy dresses.
The prince arrives in a mere 6 days, Sire Dasuos said, nearly shouting his emotions across the table. He and his family expect to be accommodated as befits their station, he said, in a warning tone.
The resources of Sevendor are at your disposal, I smiled. How many in the ducal party?
206,
answered Lord Ustal, the little lord who apparently dealt with any issues that didn't require shouting as he recited a list from memory. That is, their highnesses and the heir, their immediate household of 24,
12 gentlemen of the court, 22 attendants and servants, 4 said gentlemen, 9 ladies of the court and 15 of their servants, 3 ministers, 5 clerks, 2 law brothers, the ducal chaplain and his assistant, the chamberlain and his staff of 4, the prince's personal physician, his barber, an almoner, and 100 sergeants at arms of the royal guard. He finished proudly. He spoke the words almost as a challenge, and for most other barons it might be. Well, I will be happy to make this hall available for His Highness's use, I began in return, which should accommodate most of his household, if they're cozy. His gentlemen and ladies of the court shall have the use of the baker's hall, where my family usually lives, a fine and well-appointed home. There are adequate servants' quarters for both attached. The ministers, clerks, clergy, and other professionals shall be quartered in Southridge Hold, I said, pointing across the wall toward my brother-in-law's estate. He'd invested heavily in hostels, to take advantage of the frequent visitors to Sevendore, and he had ample capacity to house both the ducal party and my displaced kin. Moving out of their hall temporarily didn't seem to bother my parents. It bothered my sisters, but then most everything bothered my sisters. Come spring, they would return to Talrion-Boreen, where my father would reopen his bakery. They were already preparing for the move, and this gave Mama an excellent opportunity to sort out their belongings and pack some things away. As for the Royal Guard, they will be our guests at Brestall Tower, just a few miles away. I continued, we have already prepared accommodations for them. The keep is small, but there are 2 new halls within the bailey which should house your officers grandly, and the beer on that side of the vale is just as good, but a lot cheaper. I added, why, that's, I... stammered Lord Ustal, who apparently wasn't used to having his questions answered quite so easily. And what about provision? Demanded Sire Daswas. We have ample hay, oats, and straw for your party's beasts, I answered smoothly, and we can ensure we have a gracious plenty to feed our guests in style. Sufficient stocks of ale, wine, mead, and spirits have been laid in, and some of our finest cooks will be competing to dazzle the tongues of the court. The 2 men looked at each other and seemed to have a silent conversation. What about tapers? Asked Sire Dasuos, just a little less loudly than before. I laughed. My lords, this is a mage land. We have but 1 chandler and he's near starving. Folk in Sevendore use mage lights, usually. In this hall we have nothing but, I pointed out. And firewood? Lord Ustal asked, hoping to trip me up. All you need, I assured him, which won't be much. This hall and most other halls in this land are warmed by heat stones, at need. Oh, we still use fire for cooking, but rarely for heating. It really cuts down on the soot in the air during the winter, I observed, pointing to the relatively clear skies over the town in the distance. Clearly, the 2 men weren't used to being accommodated so easily. I could understand why. Usually, when a high noble toured his lands and guested with his vassals, part of the point of the exercise was to impress the rural gentry with how unsophisticated and rude they were compared to their betters. Having 200 extra mouths to feed alone could bleed a vassal of funds to the point of penury. Some counts and dukes even travelled with a moneylender, usually from some pet temple, who could arrange loans for the poor host who was forced to pay for it all by custom. An element in the tradition was to also make a lot of demands on the host and keep him hopping, trying to fill them. It was supposed to keep him humble in the face of his superiors. There were some great old myths about the lengths to which a host would go to feast his liege, most of which ended in comic horror when he failed. I didn't plan to fail. His Highness will, of course, as is tradition, hold a joint court with you while he is here, lending his magnificence to your proceedings. He is also fond of entertainments. Sire Kay is holding a tournament, I informed him, local champions only, and offering a fat prize. We have mock battles of war magi planned, a horse race, and numerous musicians, jongleurs, and poets in town for the festival, and, of course, an exhibition of the arcane illuminations from some of our most talented enchanters. The Enchanters Guild has invited the court to a special fete in their hall, and the Temple of Brigga is hosting a ball in Her Highness's honour. Oh, and then there is the wedding, I added casually, as the 2 men's eyes glazed over. The wedding? Sire Dasuos asked,
confused. "One of my new vassals is getting married to Lady Fallowen, a noblewoman of the Alca Alon. They shall be wed in front of the Everfire on Brigger's Day."
"The Alca Alon?"
Lord Ustal asked, confused.
"Those little people?"
"When they wish to appear so," I answered. "But Lady Fallowen is a maiden of great beauty and uncommon intelligence, even for an Alca Alon. She's one of the three emissaries from their people to ours, in token of our alliance."
"Is it truly proper to have such an unseemly occasion for the prince to witness?"
asked Sire Dasuus. "There is nothing unseemly about Trigg's holy sacrament, my lords," I said coolly. "The Alca Alon are our allies. This is a valuable symbol of that alliance."
"But she's not even human," Sire Dasuus complained.
"A fact in which she takes a certain amount of pride, as does her father, Lord Eritas, who will be in attendance with his men," I added. "I trust you would not be so foolish as to imperil both our alliance and your own life by saying such ill-considered things in his earshot. Lord Eritas is not known for his forgiving nature, and his love of humanity is tepid at best compared to his daughter's." That made both men go pale.
"We shall practice discretion, then," Sire Dasuos said
in an almost normal tone of voice.
"Yes,
that would be best," I agreed, rising. "Now that all the details have been dealt with, gentlemen, please enjoy the hospitality of Sevendor until His Highness arrives."
Chapter 10. The Muse Tower. Now that I had the ducal party taken care of, I had to make additional arrangements for the other important nobles who would be in attendance. After I dismissed Sire Dasuos and Lord Ustal, I had my horse saddled for a quick trip over to the westward. Baron Arathaniel of Sandaria and his party would be housed as guests in the gatehouse. I was hoping that the new Baron of Taravanel, Arathaniel's oldest son, Arlaston, could house his party at the Muse Tower. That meant I had to go speak to Dara. I could have simply spoken to her mind to mind, as my apprentice, but this wasn't, technically speaking, an arcane matter. It was a political one. Dara was a fellow noble, and when a liege imposed on a vassal, it was traditional to do so in person, or by messenger. I figured it was an excellent excuse for a lovely late winter ride through the westward, one of my favourite parts of Sevendor. In many ways, it was the estate which had changed the least since our arrival. The outer forest we'd harvested when we first came here now had a strong growth of a number of varieties of weirwood saplings, one of Olmeg the Green's pet projects. It was hedged with long rows of shrubs the herbomancer thought would do well, including some kirsieth bushes. But apart from that, the road to the westward looked much the same as it had when we came here, except it was white. The young man at the wide rope bridge that spanned the chasm between the westward and the rest of the vale recognized me and waved me through automatically. The new horse was still nervous on the bridge, but he was getting used to it. I waved to the work parties hanging out laundry in the courtyard of Westwood Hall before I took the newly made road to the newly built keep. Technically speaking, the Muse Tower wasn't a fortress, it was a muse. But when your falconer raises birds with 40-foot wingspans, no normal muse would do. The tower was built on a high shoulder of bare rock, extending from the southeast spur of Rundeval, behind my castle. The road took me up a steeply sloping path around the north side of the spur, past the kennels to the gatehouse. When I'd given the Karshak the commission to build the place, I let Dara direct the design, within reason. Thankfully, she had more good taste and good sense than most nobles with a nearly unlimited budget. The rounded archway of the gatehouse bore a large, stylized hawk, her device, with wings stretching down both sides, mage carved into the rock by Karshak masons. I knew the eyes were enchanted to glow in the darkness, but in daylight they just stared intently ahead at any who approached. Though it wasn't a fortress, the gatehouse of the tower was crenellated, a second story housing the castellan of the keep and his family, her chief falconer, Master Arcor. A couple of lads with bows sitting behind those merlons would make it difficult for anyone coming up the road. The courtyard was long and narrow. It separated the gatehouse by 100 feet, protected by a wall that enclosed the space against the side of the spur. Sturdy wooden sheds lined the wall, providing the Muse Tower with everything a master falconer might need to pursue his craft. Leather sheds, a hatchery, mews, a cold house for storing lures and feed, even a smithy. The stables were small, as there were few beasts on this side of the chasm. The skyrider on duty came out to take my horse. Just as I'd given the Karshak free rein with the design of the Muse Tower, I'd given Dara the freedom to design her corps of giant hawk riders as she saw fit. She'd adopted a quasi-military organization, similar to a mercenary cavalry regiment. Each skyrider was commissioned into the corps with due ceremony, but only after a grueling training period that included, I was surprised to learn, both the specialized sky combat the corps used, but also traditional hand-to-hand and unarmed combat. As part of their rotation, each skyrider had to serve a shift at other duties, just as any other military officer did. Today it was Jagan, a delicate-boned lad not much taller than a Tal. Dara had found him on a farmstead in Horsley when she was visiting Sir Festaran's home. His limp blonde hair lay flat on his angular head. His malnourished cheekbones were sharp enough to cut cheese with. He looked a lot better fed now than when I'd first met him 2 years before. He wore the distinctive leather jacket the Skyriders had adopted as theirs, with Dara's hawk device on his shoulder. There was a curved dagger, patterned after his mistress's mage blade, Talon, on his broad flyer's belt. A sash denoted his temporary duty as officer of the day. "Baron Menelan," he greeted me in a high tenor voice as he came out of the hall and grabbed the bridle. "What brings you here?" "I need to speak with the Hawk Lady," I said, looking up at the tower above. The sky beyond was overcast and grey. "Is she in?" "She is," he agreed as I dismounted. "She's in a mood, though," he confided. "Why? Is something amiss with Frightful?" "Nay, she's nesting on her eggs like a queen," the rustic sky rider informed me. "No, it was that wizard, Gareth. He was here this morning," he said, shaking his head. There was a troubled look in his eye. "What happened?" I demanded quietly. Jagan looked up at the tower. "Isn't my place to say. But I know he went in looking determined and came out with a wrathful expression, Baron," he said, barely above a whisper. "It's common knowledge that he set his cap for the lady," he said. "But, well, if he was paying court, it didn't go well," he confided, "and it put the lady in a state." "Good to know, Jagan," I nodded, handing him the reins. "I'll show myself up." The Muse Tower is entered through a second gatehouse that was built against the side of the spur, and the first floor of the place was split into storage rooms and the kitchen, closer to the mountain, and a grand hall overlooking Westward Hall. It was spacious, and two doors in the western wall, flanking the fireplace, led out to the point of the spur, which the Karshak had carved into a beautiful patio. I crossed the hall to gain the second staircase, which led through a second floor only slightly smaller than the first, where the eastern side of the keep abutted against the mountain. I knew that Master Guri had plans to cut a tunnel between the Muse Tower and my new mountain fortress eventually, but for now the place was largely deserted. The third and fourth floors were in the tower proper. The round keep was 80 feet in diameter at the base, but gently sloped inward as it rose. Each level had 20-foot-high ceilings and broad-arched windows, a good indoor space for training a bird. The individual skyriders had their quarters here, each assigned to a small, narrow chamber. A permanent mage light hung in the center of the high ceiling. It provided excellent lighting in the shaded hall. Dara's personal chambers were above that, on the next level. Her bedchamber and office were on the west side, with windows and a balcony looking out over the hall in which she was born. On the mountain-facing side were the chambers for her other two wing leaders. The high central chamber was a common room, with a central fireplace and another mage light overlooking a triangle-shaped table and several chairs and couches. Dara wasn't in either place. I climbed the last flight of spiral stairs to the mews, proper, my aging knees complaining at the effort. The mews for the giant hawks protruded out from the slender, 40-foot-wide tower by 20 feet in every direction. A cunning series of counterweighted snowstone arches
allowed the structure to give Dara ample room to nest her largest birds. A dozen more pointed stone arches around the perimeter of the mews were 20 feet high, and each was crafted into a separate bay. Two of the arches had been left open, allowing the hawks to take wing on command. Dara was standing near one giant nest, where her first bird, the silver-headed raptor named Frightful, was sitting on two eggs the size of ale kegs. "Master," she said evenly, without turning around. "How is she faring?" I asked, gesturing to the huge hawk.
"She's fine,"
Dara reported, still not looking at me. "She's trying to calm me down." "Why do you need calming?"
"It's personal,"
she nearly snapped. "Is there a reason you walked up all of those stairs?" "To see the Hawk Lady of Westwood and beg a boon from her. Does this have anything to do with the mountain that's missing?"
"No,"
I answered simply. "Then it concerns the prince's visit," she said with a heavy sigh. "Yes, actually. We're going to have a lot of important guests. I've put up the prince and his family at Sevendore Castle, but I was wondering if you would consider lodging Baron Arliston and his party here at the Mews Tower." That's when she looked up, sharply. She tossed her red curls out of her face and regarded me, her brow furrowed. "Do you think now is a good time to have a bunch of strangers in the tower?" she demanded. "Frightful is nesting. Anything could set her off." It didn't sound like Frightful was the problem, but I couldn't mention that after she'd invoked privacy. "We can insulate the mews from noise from the tower with magic," I proposed, "and the barony would cover the cost of feeding them."
"It's not the money that concerns me," she said through clenched teeth. "Now is just a very delicate time. Those eggs will hatch soon."
"Dara," I said patiently, "I understand. I have my own projects that I've had to postpone because of this annoying pilgrimage. Like making the entire mountain glow and then vanishing another," she accused. "You're screwing around with the snowflake again, aren't you?"
"I was," I admitted, "but it didn't work out so well. We'll try again after Tavard is safely gone. It's part of the spell I'm hoping will fix Alia."
"I know," Dara said with a dark sigh. "That's all you've been focused on for months now. Disappearing with Sire Kay over Yule and leaving me stuck running the Yule court was bad enough. Now you're back and messing with that thing."
"I am," I agreed, "but not at the moment. At the moment, I want to put about 60 Riverlords up in your keep for a few days and have you host them as befits the Hawk Lady of Westwood. After all, Baron Arliston is an ally, and you will have to deal with him on Sevendore's behalf frequently in the coming years. Best you get to know the man and allow him to get to know you. The charming, sparkling you," I added wryly.
"And what do I get out of this?" she asked sullenly. "You're the leading cadet noble house of the barony," I pointed out. "The opportunity to strengthen ties with an old and prestigious house should be enough. You know, Baron Arliston has yet to take a wife."
"That is not a consideration of mine," she said adamantly,
her nostrils flaring dangerously. I backed off.
"Still, being on friendly